Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Well, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Yesterday, Daryl Minnick, the pastor of the Good Shepherd Christian Fellowship, who we co-own our facility with, he and I met with the leaders of a church that needs a home to meet. You know, there are a lot of people who meet here. There are a lot of different groups. What I was looking for as we were relating to these people, a number of things, but one of the major things I was really listening for is, are these people cooperative, easy to get along with? Do they know how to show deference? Do they know how to make their needs known honestly, but they're willing to listen to what others have in terms to say in terms of their needs? Because what we've discovered over these many years, so the 20-something years we've been in this facility, is that when you have a number of groups meeting, you have to have this collective ethos which embodies those character traits. If you don't have that, then it can be a real drag. It can be painful. It can make the experience of sharing the facility something that we don't enjoy. But happily, over the years, we have been very fortunate. And when I met with these people, I was again pleased. I got a sense that if these people do want to meet with us, that they would be a very good addition. Now, it will require all kinds of logistical efforts, not so much on our part, because as a synagogue, we need the facility principally Friday night and Saturday, but for the other groups that meet here, it'll be something. I sense that if they choose to come, it's going to work out fine. Now, they have 80 kids. Count them, you know. How's that going to work? They describe their congregation as primarily for kids, but they let adults come, or something along those lines. You know, and I think they were being tongue-in-cheek about that. Now, our Torah portion, and the section of the Torah, the narrative section that we're in now, today, Parashat Toledot, occurs at two levels. And Stacy, in her remarks before the readings, alluded to this. In our Torah portion, we read about God doing things at this level, and then there is what we might call, in a friendly way, the soap opera level. We're talking about transcendent realities of God's covenant and the interplay of human free will and God's sovereign design to bring about his purposes for Israel through the patriarchs. And then another level, we read about Jacob and Esau. And both levels become important, the second level, because what we can distill from these stories are lessons for living. How do we live well? And quite frankly, I would guess that most of you and most of us, when we really get down to it, are less interested in the abstract things about the outworkings of history than we are about how to live and how we'd like people to treat us and all of those subjects. So it's at that level, which I'd like to talk a little bit about Jacob and Esau, David and his friend Jonathan, and about Yochanan HaMatbil, John the Immerser, and Yeshua. Now, obviously, that's a lot of material, so I'm going to have to really review here some. But the long and short of it is that at their birth, God revealed, when Jacob and Esau were born, that the elder would serve the younger. Now, he was an elder by just a few seconds, but nonetheless, this kind of reversal. But we don't know how that is going to work itself out, but we get glimpses along the way. And one of the glimpses we get is about how the family functioned. Now again, ancient people, let me tell you right now, they were not post-Freudian like we are. They didn't think as much in terms of the psychological and sociological dynamics that we do. You know, we read endlessly books about those things. But they were just concerned about survival, and they didn't have the time or the energy or, in some sense, the sophistication to think in those terms. But nonetheless, we are interested in those things, and we can really distill from these stories a lot of insight. So what we have is the two boys, and they are different, and they don't like each other very much. There's not a whole lot of common ground between them. And we find parents doing something very unwise. I'm sure it was unwise back then too, but we're really sensitized to this stuff, that one parent favors one kid and the other parent favors the other kid, and that's what happens. So what we find in this family then is a fair amount of dysfunction and sneakiness and deception and even hostility, but there were lessons embedded in all this, okay? Now, the underlying dynamic between the two boys is, who does Dad love best? You recall Kermit and Marty today? They had a similar problem, but that really is it. And when we think about it, that kind of question can really affect family life, and maybe you've seen it, and maybe you've experienced it. Now, what we find with Esau, for example, is he can't stand this brother of his who deceives him, and I'm not going to repeat the whole story. You heard much of it this morning, where Isaac is about to give a blessing to his son Esau, and when Rebekah learns about it, she gets her favorite son and says, hey, listen, you're going to miss out on the blessing. Do what I tell you. Dress up with your brother's clothes. Dad doesn't see well anymore. He's not quite with it much anymore, but he's still dad, and there's something about blessings that are very important in the biblical outlook, and I think that it's very true. So you go in, and you get that blessing. Well, that happens. And even before that, we find the boys, we see antagonism between the boys. When you'll recall this incident when Esau is out hunting, and he comes back, and he's got his bow, and he's got his arrows, and his knife, and his whole thing, and he throws it off and leaves it on the floor and goes, I am starved. I haven't eaten all day. Ooh, what's that? And Jacob, who likes hanging around the house more, he's kind of a bookworm type, kind of, he just likes that, you know, more domestic things, whatever. And he's making this lentil soup, you know. Ooh, give me some of that. And Jacob, he says, well, I'll give you some, but I want your birthright. I want the blessing of the first, the birthright, the promise that I'll get the double portion when our parents are old and they pass from this earth. And Esau says, I could care less about that. Sure, take it, birthright, schmirthright, you can have it. Just give me some of that food. And he gobbles it down. Later on, as he reflects back on his life with his brother, that rotten brother of mine, he cheated at me out of my birthright, and now he's stolen my blessing. And it says, I'm going to kill him. We're talking about real killing him here. You remember Cain and Abel, similar kind of dynamic, okay? And it's very interesting in all of our lives how we have a very selective memory when it comes to how innocent we may be in a given situation. You know, back in the time when he wanted that stew, I'll just quote this to you. He said to Jacob, quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished. And Jacob replied, well, first sell me your birthright. Look, I'm about to die. What good is the birthright to me? Jacob said, swear to me first. So he swore an oath to him selling him his birthright. And then it goes on to say, so Esau despised his birthright. You know, he remembers it as having been cheated. He was treated so terribly. He conveniently forgets that he was the one who offered to sell his birthright for a pot of lentil soup. Now, in families, sometimes we have genuine favoritism, and it's not good. In this particular case, I think a lot of it was a product of Esau's imagination. But I have a friend named Joyce, doesn't live around here, and came from a rich family in New York State, very high-functioning parents, and she had a super genius brother. And she really felt, and in her case, we believe her, that her brother was the golden boy who could do no wrong, and she was off in the shadows somewhere. And she did resent it, but she became a follower of Yeshua, became a Messianic Jew, and enveloped in the love of Messiah, all that resentment for the fact that he was favored just disappeared. You follow what I'm saying about that? You know? Okay. So anyhow, we have Esau's selective memory. And then, of course, in our passage, the dysfunction continues. We have Jacob, who was known as a conniving kind of guy, you recall from earlier episodes in his life, was Jacob the heel grabber. You know, he was always after something and didn't really care much about other people back in those days in his earlier life. So those dynamics work themselves out in the family, and here you have, he's a deceiver, his mother becomes something of a deceiver, Isaac's wife, and so they pretend, and you know the story. Now, one of the most poignant moments in the account is toward the end when Esau comes in with the tasty food that his father had asked to prepare for him before he was to get the blessing, and he says, "Dad, I'm back. I brought you something you're really going to like." His father says, "Who are you?" "Me? I'm Esau, your son. You asked me to go get you some tasty game. I got the. It's delicious, Dad. You're going to love it." Dad says, "What's going on here?" Esau says, "Dad, it's me. I'm ready for that blessing you promised." And Dad says, "I don't have a blessing for you. I gave it already." It's almost as if a blessing has a materiality that you can't just repeat it, because it's not just words. It's something that goes deeper than just words. And here we have, when Esau heard his father's words, he burst out with a loud and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me too, my father." But he said, "Your brother came deceitfully and took your blessing." And Esau said, "Isn't he rightly named Jacob, the supplanter? This is the second time he has taken advantage of me. He took my birthright," a little bit of selective memory there, "and now he's taken my blessing, and this he's right." Then he asked, "Haven't you reserved any blessing for me?" Isn't that a poignant moment in the story? I mean, it's a grabber. It really is. It really, really grabs you. And Isaac answered, "I have made him lord over you and have made all his relatives his servants. So what can I possibly do for you, my son?" And Esau said to his father, "Do you have only one blessing, my father? Bless me too, my father." And then Esau wept aloud. People cried a lot back then. You know, it was different than our culture. So we see the effects of dysfunction, and we see sneakiness, and we see a perception of power that goes one way and not both ways, because the parents reinforce that perception. I'm telling you, it's not good. And we'll talk more specifically in a little bit. Let me move quickly through Jabin and Jonathan. Here we have a very, very different relationship between two young men. The long and short of it is this. And again, we have this magnificent interplay of God's sovereign plan and human, the machinations of human choices and all, right? And so David is chosen by God to be the king, but before he becomes king, he's in King Saul's, the first king of Israel, in his entourage, in his court. Now, Saul, if he were to receive a diagnosis today, would probably be labeled a paranoid schizophrenic. And with all that comes with, and I know a fair amount about that, having a very close relative who suffered from that illness. He's also described as having a ruach, a spirit, and how to take that and the interplay of the physiology and psychology of the mind and how that interplays with the supernatural world of the demonic. No one knows how that all fits together perfectly. We can make some suggestions. But what we find is that David and Jonathan are really tight friends. But Jonathan technically is the heir to become the king after Saul passes away, his father. And Saul is concerned about his legacy, and he wants the kingship to remain within the family. But Jonathan has an entirely different attitude. Jonathan is really, really fond of his good buddy David. And he sees David's giftedness, and he sees how he has done so much for his father's family and for Israel. And he does not have a problem with David being the king. It had been prophesied as such, that David would be the king, and he doesn't mind at all. So, what do we have is, David asked Jonathan, "Why is your dad, that is King Saul, trying to kill me?" In this case, David is not being paranoid. Saul was out to kill him and tried on numerous occasions. In fact, in the passage we read this morning, Saul is so bothered by the fact that David is not present at a banquet, and thereby in some sense dishonoring King Saul, that he takes a spear and throws it at his son. Did he mean to hit him? I don't know. His son Jonathan, when Jonathan says, protests. Here's Jonathan's protest. "Then Saul's anger burned against Jonathan, and he said to him, 'You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you're choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame and the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore now, send and bring him to me, for he must surely die.' But Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, 'Why should he be put to death? What's he done?' And then Saul hurled that spear at him, so Jonathan knew that his father had decided to put David to death. Then Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and did not eat food on the second day of the new moon, for he was grieved over David just because his father had dishonored David." Jonathan's grip on the throne of Israel was just not important to him. The honor of his friend David and his safety was more important than him becoming king. And you get the sense that we're dealing with a mensch here. We're dealing with a regular guy. We're dealing with someone of admirable character because he got it about how relationships are supposed to work, how community is supposed to work, how nations are supposed to work, if you extend it. He got it. Not self-protective. Was happy to have David be king. He does say to David at one point, "Listen, when you become king, please remember my family and make sure that we're not wiped out." Because oftentimes throughout history, when the new king takes over, he looks around and wants to wipe out all the people who could possibly be his rivals. And David says, "Of course not." Last of all, let's talk about Yeshua and Yochanan. What's their relationship? Well, they were cousins. They knew each other growing up, undoubtedly. Yochanan was a Kohen. Yochanan had a big following. People really liked him. Let me quote to you. "The people were waiting expectantly and were all wondering in their hearts if Yochanan might be the Messiah. Yochanan said to them all, 'I immerse you in water. You undergo the Tevilah in water for repentance in preparation for God's coming kingdom. But one who is more powerful than I will come, and hit the straps of whose sandals I am not worthy to untie.'" So what do you have? You have Yochanan saying in another place, "He must increase, I must decrease. I don't care about being a macher. I don't care. I want God's purposes. I know the love of God. I know he has a good place for me in life. I'm happy to let it be." Now, what's the conclusion of all this? Well, The good news about Jacob and Esau is that they were reconciled years later. Did you know that? And you know, with the story, I don't want to get into the story, but it's a beautiful story about their reconciliation. But don't you wish that every married couple would erase what I like to call the power differential between them by living with this question in their minds every day? How can I make her life, or in the case of the wife thinking this, his life, a delight, not only on my terms, but on his terms or her terms too? Don't you wish that that was what characterized things? Where husbands and wives, per my message last week, got up and just said, listen, how can I make her the happiest girl in the world? Not on my terms, but love demands that it's on her terms too. And every guy would love the same. Don't you wish that world leaders would reflect on this lesson about what it means to live well in this world, not by exerting power, by bludgeoning others into submission in the name of some lofty-sounding ideology? Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't it be great if the verse I'm going to read you in a minute, I'll read it in Hebrew and English, I would love to see this verse, which I'll read you, projected over every session of the United Nations and read before every meeting of the Security Council and the General Assembly. I'll just do it in English. Here it is. If you daven shacharit, you know that this is something you read every weekday. Psalm 147, Shabbat 2, but not in our Siddur. His pleasure is not in the strength of the horse, nor his delight in the legs of the warrior. The Lord delights in those who fear him. Pardon me. The Lord delights in those who fear him, who put their hope in his unfailing love. In other words, when you get that inside of you, the love of God, and how he delights in people who love him and follow him, all of a sudden being the big mocker and getting your way all the time becomes much less important. And the feeling that you have internally of love and acceptance by him can translate much more naturally into the kind of life that's really wonderful. And I know people, let me just put it this way, I know people who get this right. And I'm telling you, whether it's marriage or friendship, it can be a little bit of heaven on earth. But you got to get this right. It's critically important. The Greendale Avenue Worship Center, that's the building that we own here, epitomizes the way the community of Messiah should work in this one respect. And here it is. We got one synagogue, we got two, perhaps three churches soon, one Christian school, two support groups for bereaved parents, one regional headquarters, and everyone meets here all the time, right? Not to mention all the extra things like concerts and all the other stuff that happens in these four walls. Now, it's happened for 26 years, we've done this, without any major complications. Not one. Not one. Why? Because we have chosen to take the ideas embedded and inferred by this passage seriously. And I want to encourage you to go and do likewise. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
Please, O Lord, our God, may the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, may the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. And may your descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those who know your name and study your Torah for Messiah.